call to order the House Education Committee on March 13th, 2017. We have kind of a full agenda with lots of speakers, but first of all, I'd like to welcome the folks from OSBA on their lobby day. So welcome to the House Education Committee. Okay, what we're going to do is open a public hearing on HJR 4. Alethea, if you could introduce the committee measure, please.
Yeah, Chair Doherty, members of the committee. HJR 4 removes the requirement that the Legislative Assembly publish a report that demonstrates appropriation of money to ensure the state system of education meets quality goals. It removes the reporting requirement demonstrating the appropriation money is sufficient or identifying reasoning for the insufficiency. It allows the proposed amendment to be submitted to the people for approval or rejection at the next general election.
Okay, thank you. Okay, the first panel we have is Betty Reynolds and Jim Green. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm Betty Reynolds. I'm president of Oregon School Boards Association, and I also chaired OSBA's advisory group regarding revenue reform. OSBA's top legislative priority is adequate and stable funding for education. And House Joint Resolution 4 is one element of our proposal to fully fund Oregon's quality education model. And we hope that it will assure that all kids can fulfill their promise. We hope that you consider it favorably. And Madam Chair, with your permission, I'd like to defer to Jim Green, to Executive Director of OSBA, to explain the proposal in more detail.
Okay, thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Jim Green, Executive Director of the Oregon School Boards Association. Thank you for hearing this bill today. I think this is my first time in front of you this session, so hopefully it won't be my last. I provided your staff with three documents that are in the OLA system for you to take a look at with regard to HJR 4. One is a background brief done by your legislative research office on the quality education model. One is the executive summary of the final report of the quality education model written by the Quality Education Commission. And then the report that came out this January 16, from the Joint Committee on Public Education Appropriation, and Representative Springer was a member of that joint committee. Essentially what House Joint Resolution 4 is designed to do is to tell you all to fund the quality education model. One thing I know that we would need to amend into it is a right of action against the legislature, and I'm sure you'll all sign up for that amendment to be sued by folks when you don't fund the QEM. But in all seriousness, the QEM has been around for over 16 years, and we've never met the obligation to fund a quality education model. And you generally hear from folks, well, it's just a number. It is actually not just a number, and that's why I provided you the summary. And it does have a link to the full report, which is multiple pages, and I wanted to spare you that. It really looks at what we need to do for boys and girls in the state of Oregon to provide them a quality education. Yes, there is a price tag associated with that because we have not come close to what we need to do for it. But it really talks about prototypical schools, what you want in your schools, and what we would need in our schools in order to provide the type of education we all want for boys and girls in the state of Oregon. So if you look at your research report, I think it's probably the best summation of the quality education model. It talks about the 11-member QEC, the Quality Education Commission, which is appointed and confirmed by the Senate, made up of educators and folks around the state to really delve into the research and the data to show what works for boys and girls across the state of Oregon. And if you look through that document on the second page, it talks about prototypical schools, including adequate staffing, added instructional time, curriculum development, and technology support. And when you look at the size of schools out there, very few of our medium to large size school districts have schools in this range. But in order for an elementary school to be what prototypical is about 340 students. It has all-day kindergarten, class sizes that average 20 in grades 1 through 3, class sizes of 24 in grades 4 through 5, and full-time specialists in art, PE, music, and a variety of programs. And I see, Madam Chair, you're giggling. You know we don't have this across our school districts. You may not know, I also sit on the Salem-Keizer School Board, so I ran our numbers with regard to what we look like as the second largest school district in the state. Our elementary schools range in size from Auburn Elementary, which has 690 students in an elementary school in K through 5, down to Forest Ridge, which has 244, one of our smaller outlying schools. When you look at middle schools, the prototypical school should be about 500 students. In Salem-Keizer, we have the largest at Stevens Middle School at 1,099, down to Parrish at 721. And I can tell you, when you look at the things that are supposed to be available, a counselor for every 250 kids. I can tell you, my daughter's in middle school here in the town. We don't have a counselor for every 250 students. It's more like 400 to 450 students per counselor in our middle schools and in our high schools. And I think that's pretty prototypical across the state. High schools should be about 1,000 students. When you look at our six comprehensive high schools in Salem-Keizer, you have McKay High School, 2,456, and Sprague at 1,766. And I know, looking at your school districts that you represent on this committee, that's not atypical across the districts. Our schools are too big. They don't have the resources they need to address student needs. And the one tool that we do have that has been around for 17 years that says to folks how to fund it is the quality education model. The model is a living, breathing document. They meet every 2 years and revise the document. This last one looked at what would it take for us to get to 40-40-20 by the year 2025. Surprisingly, I guess not surprisingly, we're $1.8 billion off the mark, and that gap continues to widen. At some point, we either have to scrap the QEM or step up to the plate and fund what we all know for boys and girls. And I don't think we want to scrap it because it's had a lot of data. It's had a lot of real folks look at it and say it is what we ought to be doing in schools. The problem is the inability to fund it. And no offense to you, Representative Springer, but I've read these reports every 2 years on the adequacy of funding, and they change the dates in the reports to say we don't have the money to fund it. And I think we ought to have the money to fund it. In a poll that we did just recently, 66% of Oregonians support you funding the quality education model. 57% say even if it costs $2 billion more, you ought to be funding the quality education model. It is the most important thing you do as a legislator in the eyes of Oregonians, and it is probably the greatest inadequacy we currently have in our system of schools across the state. We don't fund it adequately. And if you fund it, you ought to expect outcomes. You ought to see our graduation rates raise. And if you read the report, that's exactly what it says. In order to get our graduation rates to 90% by the year 2021, we should make these investments in third grade reading, ninth grade on credit, everything you know that works in school districts across the state. So I would encourage you to at least move this resolution on down to Ways and Means, and I'm sure all of you will sign up to have an amendment drafted so that we can ensure that if you don't fund it, somebody gets to sue you in that matter.
Thank you. Any questions of this panel? Representative McLean.
Well, first of all, you know, I mean, I don't think that there's anybody up here that doesn't want to fund the quality education model. And as far as people suing me, I like to go to compromise before suits. But looking at your resolution and on page or on lines 12, 13, and 14, what you've identified there is only one system of funding. And the one system of funding is equalization grants to eligible districts for each year in which the voters of each district approve local option taxes as described in Article 11 and Section 11 of the Constitution. The amount of such grants and eligible criteria would be determined by the Legislative Assembly. And we do know that we also fund per pupil. And we do hear often, and we've heard this year many times with people who have testified in front of us already, that flexibility on how we fund and how that money comes to them that's not siloed but able to be used in a variety of different ways for different needs, whether it be textbooks, you know, staff, or anything else. So I'd just like to have you respond a little bit to those lines and tell me specifically why a grant program.
So, Madam Chair, Representative McLean, that's existing language within the Constitution. That was put in, I believe, during the debates around ballot measure 47 and ballot measure 50, where local school districts were given those the opportunity to go out for equalization grants. And this was part of a process to establish a system to allow eligible districts to approve those and have grants to come from the state to offset those. We still have many school districts in the state who use those local option grants and have availability of them, and there is a provision that you pointed out here in the Constitution that requires that to continue forward. Whether, in fact, you want to change that or not, I think, is an issue, because do you really want to say to the voters of a local school district, we're not going to let you support your schools outside of your local property tax rate? Now, I know in Madam Chair's district, the issue of compression makes a local option very tough in the Tiger-Tualatin School District. I believe the last time they went out, they were told they could raise somewhere in the neighborhood of $7 million, and due to compression, they were only able to raise $3 million through local option. But it has been one of those issues that when the state took over funding due to Ballot Measure 5, you still wanted to give the opportunity to local school districts to have some modicum of local control over what they wanted to do within their process. Whether, in fact, that's something that you want to continue, I think that could be a continual debate around that, because you have districts who could never pass a local option, or you have districts whose compression is so hard on them that they couldn't raise anything even if they went out for a local option. So I think it's one of those issues that still needs to be looked at. Our resolution was to deal with the issue of the QEM, to really force the hand of the legislature to fund the quality education model and stop the reports that have been coming out that essentially say the same thing, as I said before, with just the dates changed and the names changed on the report.
Madam Chair, I would like to address two of the comments that you made. First of all, what I was saying, you were still talking to me about limitations, not opportunity. And so I appreciate the fact that the conversation on the funding mechanism from 12 to 14, you know, needs to be further discussed. I will tell you that in a work group that we did this summer on the size of classrooms, mm-hmm. you know, as far as the ratio between teacher and student, that we had quite a large conversation around the reports on the quality education model. Totally support. I don't need a report telling me I can't fund it. But I will tell you that I did find some value in those reports, and I found, because I looked back over the last 10 years to look at some of the reports, and they picked up different topics, they picked up different areas to update, and they took on the conversation, very hard conversation, of what the current service level is for the quality education model. And even in this last summer, we found some issues and some conversation around what is that number, and how do we make sure that the number is updated and appropriate and correct? So I do think that they've done more than just change the dates, but I agree with you that we should do more than have a report.
And Madam Chair, Representative McClain, don't get me wrong. Our association is supportive of, obviously, trying to get to a quality education model as soon as we can. But if it's a glide slope into the next 3 to 4 years, that's better than where we've been ever before. And this tees up the conversation along some of the lines that you just brought up.
Thank you. Representative Springer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thanks for calling me out a couple times, Jim. I think I've been on this committee since right after I came in the legislature in 08, and it's been a very frustrating process, quite frankly, because we come up with a number and then we move on. The commission comes up with a number, brings it before our committee, and then we move on. That's really frustrating. But what I want you to speak to briefly, because this comes up often and this could be a big conversation, but the chair might gavel you down, so briefly. Representative Betty Comp started this conversation many years ago, and mm-hmm. I kind of chimed in with her because there was some value in it. We have changed so much in education over the last 16 years. Why is this model still relevant, and how has this model changed, morphed, if it is still relevant? How has it changed to keep up with all of the changes? Because 16 years ago, education in the state looked drastically different as far as the nuts and the bolts. Talk to us a little bit about that.
Sure, Madam Chair, Representative Springer, and one of the things we always say is, please stop moving the goalposts on us.
Yep.
Tell us what we're doing and what you want in K-12 education, and we'll get the job done. But as you so eloquently said, you, the Department of Ed, the U.S. Department of Ed, a variety of policymakers have moved those goalposts for us. And we spend a lot of time, a lot of energy, and a lot of money to catch up on those changes. And to be honest with you, it gets a little frustrating. But I think one of the things that the quality education model does do is, as in the last iteration, they looked at what you said is the goals for the state of Oregon. 40-40-20 by the year 2025. What do we need to get there? That is a legislatively adopted goal with regard to 40% of our kids with a bachelor's degree and 40% of our kids with some sort of certificate and 20% of our kids graduating from college ready to go into the workforce. That's a number you all came up with at the legislature. So the quality education model has adapted over time, because remember, early on in the quality education model, many of you will remember this, certificates of initial mastery, certificates of advanced mastery, one of the goalpost changes. We had OAKS, we've had SBAC, we've had No Child Left Behind, we've had a variety of things, and it's a little frustrating, but you did land on 40-40-20, so the Quality Education Commission took a look at what would it take for us to get there. And to be honest with you, it's not a very pretty picture when you take a look at our current funding situation where we need to get. But I think if you talk to school board members and school administrators across the state, if you're willing to put money behind the program, we will show you outcomes for boys and girls, because the model shows that. If you want to get to 90% of your students graduating on time, you have to put the money into K-3 and third grade reading, ninth grade credit on time. All those benchmarks that all education researchers can tell you, this is where we know kids are going to be if you do this. The amount of time kids are absent. I encourage you to read the full report. It's actually pretty good reading, and you'd be shocked to go, I thought we were doing this. And there are some districts who are doing really well at it, and there are some who are not. And I think one of the things you'd hear from school district administrators, from teachers, from classified employees, is it's a lot of work out there, and not given the resources makes that work even tougher for boys and girls in this state. And I know you all want to do the best you can for boys and girls. This is just an opportunity that we've been waiting 16 years for, and I think it tees up the discussion quite nicely.
Thank you for the brief answer.
I tried.
Anytime.
Okay, any other questions to this panel? Okay, thank you very much. Okay, next we have Tim Sweeney, Sam Dow, and Sammy Huffman. Welcome.
Good afternoon. Thank you for letting us visit with you this day. I'm the superintendent of the Coquille School District on the South Coast.
And your name is?
Timothy Sweeney.
Thank you.
All right. And with me is Sammy Huffman, one of our high school students, and Sam Dow, another high school student at Coquille High School. We're doing a lot of the great things that you just heard Jim talk about. We do have class size reductions. We do have kindergarten classes in the 18s and elementary classrooms in the 22-24 range until you get to sixth grade, where we're at 35 kids per class at our elementary school, because we don't have the funds to quite get that next teacher. We have alternative ed, and we have early learning at our school, and we do a lot of fun and innovative things, but that all comes at a cost. And Sam's going to talk to you a little bit about that in a moment. We don't have everything we need. We've done great things, and that's because of the work you've done. You've moved the needle on funding for K-12. But at 7.8, that needle doesn't move anymore, and we look at a $500,000 reduction to our school district for next year. That's a combination of six teachers or 12 EAs or school days, however that works. We need more. We don't need tons more, but we need more. We want to keep growing as a school district. We want to keep offering great things for our students, and we're doing that. And these girls would like to just share with you what they do and what they miss as part of the Coquille School District, and what the good things are and what some of the things aren't. Sam?
Thank you.
Hi. I'm Sam, obviously. I was put into the foster care system my sophomore year of high school, and I moved seven times that year, so it was a really rough year for me. And most of the year I stayed at one school, But I had a counselor that was there every single day, 5 days a week, and I could talk to him whenever I needed to and get any of the help I needed. But when I ended up in Coquille, there's a counselor there, but she's there 3 to 4 times a month, and she's not one that I can exactly open up to as much as my old one, and it was a huge transition for me going from having somebody there for me all the time to basically nobody, because I didn't know any of the students at the school. I didn't, like, it was just a really rough time for me. And also, a nurse at our school would be really great, because there are a lot of students there that struggle with health problems that they haven't yet gotten diagnosed, or they just don't want to reach out to somebody and they need actual help. I think that's all I have. Thank you, guys.
Okay, thank you very much.
Yeah, it's a student population in the district of 1,100, so we have counseling 1.5 days a week. But at the high school, only 1 day a week, and the other half day is spread out through the other schools. We have one nurse at our school district. She's housed at the elementary school. If there's a crisis at the high school, she would go over there. But with more, we could do more. We could offer our kids more.
Thank you.
Yeah. So recently we just got our band program back for K-12.
Make sure we have to say who you are so the record knows who you are officially.
I'm Samantha Huffman. I'm a freshman at Coquille High School. Mm-hmm. Recently, we just got our band program back, K-12, and I participated in that band program for about 2 years now. We also got our drama program back. We went from a class of 7 students to a class of 30, and they're able to put on their own productions now. We also took our art program from a room where a teacher could watch you to now we have full-blown art classes where you learn spinning wheel, pottery, all kinds of different art techniques from a professional, and I couldn't imagine if we had to cut down, we'd have to remove so many teachers, and our favorite programs, like our arts programs, would be in jeopardy. And it's proven that people who participate in these programs have better math and English scores. And it's definitely better when I go into the band room each morning, I lug my saxophone in there, I sit down, I talk to my teacher, I talk about what I'm going to do that day, what I need to accomplish. He lets me study. He lets me figure out what I need to do. I couldn't imagine not going into a band room or an arts room every day to just relax and learn something new. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. Any questions of this panelist? Okay, you guys did a great job.
Can I just say, Coquille has some of the best teachers that I've ever had, and I don't want to see their school losing any of them.
And she's not allowed to say this, but Sammy here is Miss Coos County Outstanding Teen. So
excellent.
We're very proud of her.
Good. We want to brag a little bit.
Yes, we do.
Yes, thank you very much. Okay, I'll do this. Okay, and the last two we have signed up, our last three, one's for Elsie, is Morgan Allen, Tyler Shipman, and Mark Thielman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Morgan Allen here on behalf of the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators. Just wanted to express our support of HDR4 and our continuing goal of trying to fully fund the quality education model. In the interest of time, I'll just give you a few obligatory statistics about school funding in Oregon. And never go after the kids. I always forget that part. Never go after the kids. But from the most recent Quality Education Commission report that came out last August, I just wanted to read a couple things into the record. The first is, when adjusted for inflation, Oregon has had virtually no increase in per-student funding since 1990-1991. Also from the latest Quality Education Model report, Oregon had the second lowest growth in spending per pupil in the United States over the 1990-91 to 2014-15 period, 49th. Does that sound like a familiar statistic, 49th? Another unbiased report from Education Week. In school finance, Oregon ranks 34th. In academic achievement, Oregon ranks 37th. From the National Center for Education Statistics, this is the most recent data from the 2013-14 school year, the average per pupil spending in the United States is over $11,000. In Oregon, it's a shade under $10,000. From a good analysis from the Oregonian newspaper in 2015, Oregon schools produce results that rank in the bottom third nationally, partly because Oregon lags far behind the national average in classroom spending. Two central findings of this analysis by the Oregonian, and they are Oregon schools rank 38th in performance and 39th in spending per student adjusted for cost of living. The reason I just wanted to get a couple of those on the record is we have a lot of conversations and appropriate conversations in this body about cost drivers and OEB and PERS and graduation rates and how we spend the money and all that type of stuff. But it's important to remember there is absolutely a relationship between investments and outcomes. And you notice that those numbers are often very close together in the bottom third for both outcomes and inputs for investments. And so I just wanted to get that on the record and again express our support for the resolution. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Chair Doherty, members of the committee, my name is Tyler Shipman and I am a government relations specialist with the Oregon School Employees Association. Our association represents over 21,000 educational employees. Our members include bus drivers, janitors, educational assistants, and other educational support staff. I am here today to testify in support of HJR4. Out of respect of your time, I'll try to be brief since most of what I had has been covered by the previous panels. As you know, the QEM identifies components of a quality education and then estimates the cost of that. Currently, our education system is funded $1.81 billion under the recommendations provided by the QEM. This is significant for classified staff. Since the layoffs that occurred during the recessions, our staffing levels still haven't returned to what they were. In a time span from 2006 to 2014, we saw a 5% decrease in the number of full-time equivalent SPED paraprofessionals. In that same time, we saw a 6% increase
in
the number
of... And that's special ed?
Yeah, yes. Special education. We saw a 6% increase in the number of special education students in Oregon. Using the QEM funding comparisons under a prototype elementary school, which has 340 students, fully funding at the QEM as compared to the current level would provide one additional FTE instructional support staff, and it would decrease kindergarten class sizes by two. These are both proven methods of increasing educational development of students. As you've heard, Oregon has among some of the largest class sizes, shortest school year, and some of the lowest per pupil spending in the nation. OSEA thinks it's time to fully support and fund Oregon's educational system. And as such, we support this bill.
Okay, thank you. Next.
My turn. I don't have anything quite so eloquent or depressing prepared. I'm Superintendent Mark Thielman from ALSI School District, very small school district. We're looking at a very similar bleak picture and also losing music, that kind of thing. But rather than dwell on that, I've spent a lot of time up here working with all kinds of people and talking to a whole bunch of legislators and analysts. And the situation, as Rep. McLean said, you guys don't need us to tell you the value of funding education. You also know there's no money. And there's no money because we've spent a couple of decades putting our money into other services and things at the detriment of education. That is a fact. We take money, we don't give it to education, we invest it in something else that's important. And the problem is if you do that for 25 years, you end up with what these guys just said. We're now scraping the bottom so that we're in this bumping along the bottom of the can. And I hear it in your testimony, but at some point, I just really want to strongly encourage, we need to have a very courageous and very real conversation. We absolutely have to have a healthcare solution. It's killing schools. And so all of us have fixed our costs in terms of what we cover, and now we're asking teachers to pick up the difference. So in my district, I have zero employees on family coverage because they can't afford it. It's $1,100 a month out of pocket. And that is a cost control that we had to do in order to put teachers in the classroom. These are real issues. And this is the cost of not funding at QEM when we could have done it. And QEM kept us from taking that money. It would have kept us from taking that money and putting it somewhere else. It would have forced us to keep it on the education side of the economy and the state budget. Education generates dollars. Kids go out into the workforce. All the research is clear. It's a 25% give back after 10 years. So a dollar spent, 10 years later, $1.25 comes back. Had we done that 20 years ago, we would have a bigger revenue pie. just for the simple fact of investing in education. The other issue is we have no revenue. We really need the business community to come to the table, whether it be a sales tax, or some other kind of business tax. Now, when I go to business people, and I've been to them, a variety of them in different organizations and different entities, both large and small, they all tell me, if I knew the money would go to K-12, I would support an increase. And I've had those conversations. OSBA had polling that supports that. That's powerful. The time to move is now. People will support revenue increases, unlike the last 97 that they didn't support, if they had a constitutional guarantee. It would go to schools. The QEM, as per the amendment to this bill, would do that. And it does it by taking out a comma, the most powerful comma in the world. The comma that changed the definition of the word shall, which in Oregon State statute, law, and precedent, always means you have to do it. But except this one grave exception. And to me, it's not persuasive. It's not defensible. So that we have to have an entire piece of legislation to basically take out a comma. But that's what we need to do in order to shift the burden of revenue investment back towards the thing that actually generates money and grows the pie in the long run. Growing education generates more money for firefighters, policemen, transportation, and human services. Those are facts. We've been neglecting the engine while investing in fenders and paint. All of those things are important for a safe, well-working car. I understand that, but we need to change it up real quick. The third one is PERS. We have to have some kind of solution, and the only solution is to attach PERS reform of some kind, like get out of the defined benefit business and give people lucrative 401k-style investments. That is called retiring with dignity. Let people have a stake and some skin in their own retirement, whether they're a public employee or a private, because the taxpayers don't get the benefit. So I'm just to strongly encourage you, let this bill and this quality education model be the engine that brings those things together. No point in doing it without revenue, right, Rep. Doherty? Chair? We need cash to do it. Any questions?
Any questions to this panel? Okay, none. Thank you, gentlemen, very much.
Thank you.
Okay, those are the only ones that we have signed up today. Anybody else on HJR4? Okay, with that, I close the public hearing on HJR4. I was going to open up an informational hearing on occupational therapists. Do we have them here today? Yes, we do. And so, Sandra, Marshall, and Julia. Okay, great. Thank you. Thank you for coming today.
Thank you, Chair Doherty, and thank you, members of the committee, for allowing us this hearing, and thank you, Rep. McLean, for introducing this bill. My name is Julia Damon, and I am an occupational therapist who is licensed in the state of Washington and in the state of Oregon. I also have a teaching certificate in the state of Oregon. I am an adjunct professor at Pacific University, and I am a co-chair on the legislative committee of the Occupational Therapy Association of Oregon. Occupational therapists... So House Bill 3263 involves introducing guidelines around workloads for occupational therapists working in school-based settings. Occupational therapists are key contributors to the educational team. We meet the child where they're at and focus on performance skills. We are a federally mandated related service under IDEA, and we focus on fine motor skills, sensory processing disorders, behavioral analysis, environmental modifications, and assistive technology, among other things.
Now, this is an informational hearing, so we're not talking about the bill. We're talking about occupational therapy.
Oh, pardon me.
Yes.
Sorry. occupational therapy in the school setting plays an integral role in the education team.
We help to evaluate students who in need of service, and we also design treatment plans around their performance deficits. So, for example, if a child has a fine motor deficit, then we are able to give them direct service. We look at their grasp. We look at their bilateral coordination, which is their ability to use two hands at the same time. We look at their ability to integrate their visual skills with their hand skills. And so how that affects education is it allows them to perform better in handwriting in tabletop tasks such as cutting with scissors or folding paper. It also allows them to fit their classroom environments better. So children, especially children on the spectrum, often experience sensory processing disorders, and they're not able to tolerate a classroom setting the same way that a typically developing child is. So an occupational therapist will come in and provide adaptive equipment that'll help them better modulate their sensory input, such as a weighted vest or a weighted blanket. We also provide seating adaptations to children with low tone or high, too low tone or too high tone, to better engage the child in their educational program. We provide writing easels. We provide iPads. We refurbish equipment. We work with occupational therapy assistants we supervise them so that they're able to carry on our treatment plans. We also work in transition programs, helping children from age 16 to 21 to leave the school system and then carry on into higher education or independent living once they graduate from school. Determination of services happen through the IEP process, we are involved in the IEP process so that we can ensure that children with disabilities receive a free and appropriate education in the least restrictive environment. So that means the environment in which they're most closely receiving an education alongside typically developing peers. We are here today as clinicians within the educational system to ask that you acknowledge the importance of occupational therapy within a school district, and so that you can maybe hear our reasoning in the future behind our introduction of this bill.
Okay, thank you.
Hi, Chair Doherty and members of the committee, thank you for hearing me today. My name is Michelle Painter, and I'm an occupational therapy assistant, and I currently work as faculty with Lynn Benton Community College in their occupational therapy assistant program and teach students there. But prior to becoming faculty, I was a clinician and practitioner in the school setting for 27 years. So I have extensive background in working in the school setting with occupational therapist providing services to kids on IEPs and IFSPs. And the reason why I'm here today is to talk about the crisis that we have with too few OTs being able to provide services in the schools. We have a real crisis in that there are OT practitioners that are having caseloads 80, 90, 100 students and up. And the services are being watered down to nothing more than checking in once every couple of months with the kids. And I have lived this experience with serving kids. I have worked with OTs that we've had huge caseloads and have not been able to provide the minimum standards and the minimal level of service that's on their IEP. And it creates quite an ethical dilemma for us as practitioners to be able to provide quality services to these kids as it's outlined on their IEP. And frequently, OTs that I've worked with have contacted the OT licensing board because they are fearful of their of something coming against their license because they're not meeting the minimum hours on the IEP, or they just burn out after a year. They just can't stay in a practice setting where they are putting in more than 8-hour days. They're not seeing all the kids that are on IEPs, and it's quite a crisis. Another thing that is happening in this setting is that in order to manage these huge caseloads, OTs are having to basically hand it off to unskilled classroom assistants in the hopes that they will provide the services in the classroom. And these individuals are not licensed in Oregon. They are not skilled professionals. They do not know how to adjust a treatment plan for a child so that it fits that child or changes as the child's skill level changes. These unskilled, untrained paraprofessionals are not able to do that.
I want to remind you, this is an informational hearing, so
yes,
I thought you were going to talk about what the assistants do.
And what the assistants do is we provide that skilled service for those children that are on IEPs, and we are able to make those adjustments to their plan. If a child's condition changes or if they have a very complex medical condition, which many of them do in our schools, we are able to work through the occupational therapist's treatment plan. We're able to provide that hands-on service and not pass it off to another individual who doesn't know how to follow the IEP. So I just wanted to share that with you, the realities of what it is in Oregon in the schools with occupational therapists, and I'm available for questions if you have any.
Okay, thank you. Thank you.
Good afternoon. My name is Sandra Rogers. I appreciate the opportunity to speak before you, and I am licensed in the state of Oregon as an occupational therapist. I'm a faculty member at the only OT school in the state of Oregon, as Michelle is for the OTAs at Lynn Benton. And I would like to talk about, I understand that we're here to talk about what occupational therapists do in schools, and so I just wanted to emphasize a couple of points that Julia and Michelle have made about the kinds of things that occupational therapists do in the school system. One of the first things that we do is direct intervention, and so we work directly one-on-one with children, improving in the three primary categories of kids that we work with are kids who have autism, kids who have cerebral palsy, and kids who have intellectual impairment. So those are the three primary groups. We provide them with opportunities to participate as fully as it is possible within a classroom setting. So we try and enable them to be able to participate in their classroom with the least restrictions possible. We provide direct services to enable them to do that. We also provide more indirect services, and this would be consultation for those kiddos who are not so severely impaired that they are don't need direct one-to-one treatment. They could benefit from some consultation, and so you could work with the schools and the teacher within the classroom to help them identify modifications to the environment, modifications to their schoolwork, so that they can participate more fully in the classroom. In addition to those kinds of activities, both the direct service and the indirect service, therapists participate on IEP teams, identifying the kids who need to have these services. And as Michelle's pointing out, some kids are identified, over 100 kids on for one therapist. And so by a caseload or workload definition, you cannot serve that many children adequately. It places these therapists in somewhat unethical positions because they're trying to provide the services that is they're physically not capable of providing because there just isn't enough time in a school year to be able to provide those services.
Okay, thank you. Are there any questions for the panel? Representative Springer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I know part of the conversation is OT assistance, but did I hear that there's one school that offers a program? And if we had the ability to have more OT assistance in the schools, do we have the pipeline to educate those people to be in the school?
Yes, Madam Chair Doherty and Representative Springer and members of the committee, thank you. Yes, we have one school in Oregon, the Occupational Therapy Assistance School, and we graduate about 24 students per year, and they go into a variety of practice settings. Many of them do want to practice in school settings with occupational therapists and work with kids, but there are limited opportunities over the last few years to expand and increase occupational therapy assistance in the schools because the prevailing thought or the habit has been just to hire occupational therapists. But occupational therapy assistants can do pretty much almost everything that an occupational therapist can do, including contributing to the development of the IEP, administering some standardized assessments under the supervision of an occupational therapist, and can provide that direct service. The OT is primarily responsible for that evaluation, but the OTA can do a wide range of tasks very similar to what the OT can do in the school setting with kids. So it does make sense to increase the numbers of occupational therapy assistants in the schools to help with the caseload issue.
Okay. Any other questions?
I heard you say that there were two schools, one that worked on the program for the occupational therapists and one for the assistants. So where's the other school and how many graduates do you have?
Madam Chair and Representative McLean, there is one school for the professional level occupational therapist at Pacific University and one school at Lynn Benton for the occupational therapy assistant. Okay. So we just have the two schools for the two levels of practitioner.
Thank you. Okay, any other questions? Okay, seeing none. Anybody else on the panel? We've got the three of you signed up. Okay, if not, we'll close the informational hearing on occupational therapists, and we're going to have to take a time out.
Thank you.
Oh, we're going to stand at ease just for a few minutes.
Okay.
Actually, we're going to change things up, and I'm going to open up a public hearing on House Bill 2898. Alethea, if you could talk about this.
Chair Doherty, members of the committee, House Bill 2898 requires the Department of Education to develop by rule a method for analyzing progress toward high school graduation, including credit deficiency and dropout rate for any student population the Department of Education calculates for graduation rate currently. The reporting requirements are effective for the 2018-2019 academic year.
Okay, so Marcia Koba, John Bullock, Iris Marie Chavez, and Tim Cowan, if you want to come up after them, we'll do that. Okay. Thank you for going a little early. We're ahead of schedule.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Chair Doherty and members of the committee, my name is Marshall Koba, representing the Oregon Virtual Academy in support of House Bill 2898. Oregon Virtual Academy is a virtual public charter school with an independent board and about 2,450 students K through 12 and our charters with the North Bend School District. Improving Oregon's graduation rate is a clear and urgent priority for our state. We know that there are many efforts underway, including those led by Chief Innovation Officer Colt Gill, Dr. Knorr, and his team at ODE. We believe House Bill 2898 is complementary and aligned with those efforts. We believe also it's a rather benign bill that will assist the state in assessing student progress towards graduation and an important effort in collecting more and better data. House Bill 2898 amends ORS 329105, which states in its introductory line, the superintendent of public instruction shall collect data and produce annual school district and school performance reports to provide information to parents and to improve schools. And we think this data will help to improve data and to improve schools. The bill adds to this data collection by allowing the department, by rule, to develop a method for analyzing the progress towards high school graduation for any student population that the department calculates a graduation rate to determine four key things. One, the percentage of students who are credit deficient and the degree of credit deficiency after each academic year. Two, the change year over year in degree of credit deficiency among credit deficient students. The third is the dropout rate among credit deficient students. And the fourth is the change year over year in the dropout rate among credit deficient students. Currently, Oregon tracks whether or not ninth grade students finish their first year of high school on track to graduate. This is 6 credits. As this has been determined to be a promising indicator of the future likelihood of success or dropping out. However, this data collection is limited to just the ninth grade, and we are aware of no other annual identification of students who are off track to graduate in other grade levels. House Bill 2898 is to develop a method to analyze progress towards graduation that includes credit deficiency, with ODE in the lead as far as how to do it. For the Oregon Virtual Academy, the ability to analyze progress towards graduation that includes credit deficiency is critical information, as many of our students enroll behind in their credits and are unlikely to graduate on time. This data would be helpful to us, but would also be helpful to every other school in Oregon. To be clear, the bill does not make any changes to the grad rate calculation, but we do believe that understanding the rate in the context of student progress toward graduation is critical to improving how we support our students on their path towards graduation. This data would support educators as they determine the needed support for students and help schools determine if they are closing the gap for credit deficient students. The report required in Section 2E could be added to any one of the several annual reports already produced by ODE regarding graduation and or dropout rates. This report, using the new credit deficient and dropout rate data, will help schools support their students and help the public better understand the how and why of high school graduation rates. We understand the ODE does not currently collect this data, but we believe it's feasible, desirable, and a positive step for all students and schools in Oregon. And we thank you for this hearing and urge your support of House Bill 2898.
Okay, thank you very much. Next.
Good afternoon, Chair Doherty, members of the committee. My name is Iris Maria Chavez, and I work with a coalition of Oregon's community-based charter schools. I'm here today to speak in support of House Bill 2898. As Marshall Koba mentioned, this bill really is a complement to some of the other work that's already ongoing at Oregon's Department of Education. I specifically, as do my schools, feel that it complements the work that Colt Gill is doing with his early indicator system, a bill that will be heard on the Senate side tomorrow. That bill will look at how students in K-8 are progressing and where we need to provide supports and interventions to get them to graduation. We also have, as Marshall mentioned, looks at ninth grade on track and looking at credit deficient students, how they're progressing towards graduation is a third piece of that puzzle that will help us have a more clear understanding of where our students need more support in order to get to graduation. So as we try and look at the whole student, how they're doing in school, and where we as a local school, a school district, and the state can provide the best supports through either practice or policy, we feel strongly that this is a critical piece of that information. So we would like to urge your support on House Bill 2898.
Okay, thank you.
Chair Doherty, members of the committee, my name is John Bullock, and I'm the executive director of the Redmond Proficiency Academy, 6 through 12 charter school in Redmond, Oregon, serving about 850 students from throughout Central Oregon. I'm here to support House Bill 2898. I believe one critical role that public charter schools play in the public education system is providing an opportunity to explore innovative educational practices. One important practice is the use of data to make decisions in the best interest of our students. And so in partnership with the Redmond School District, I engaged in an analysis of graduation data because we recognize that the graduation rates in Oregon are not where we would like them to be. And so we wanted to take a look at how do graduation rates, funding, and credit requirements all tie together. And the result of that was a white paper that was submitted electronically in your testimony. One product of that white paper was the understanding that Oregon has the highest number of credits required of any state. There are 10 states in the country that have 24 credits as their graduation requirement. And we wanted to look at Redmond School District non-graduates to see how many of them were close to what would be the national average for number of credits. And we determined that 22% of our non-grads over the past 2 4-year cohorts had 20 plus credits but did not have enough credits to graduate. We discovered that 50% had less than 12 credits. And so from that, what we examined was those students that had 20 plus credits, were they to graduate in some way or form, it would increase the overall graduation rate of our district by 7 or 8 percentage points, which is a significant increase. One of the struggles that we have is that it requires a great amount of individual school time to compile all this data for every student. But if there are a way in which the state could help every school compile this data, we might do a better job of determining which students are off track and where, and then allow us to continue with the innovative practices we use, such as having graduation coaches that work with students once they're identified to be behind the credit trajectory and help put them on track. And so as the director of a charter school and as a believer in public education, I'm here in full support of House Bill 2898. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. Any questions? Representative Springer?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for your testimony. So as I read the bill, the new language and then the existing language, and this is a conversation, I don't know if you were in the room when we had this probably 2 weeks ago, and my concern is that it really isn't in the best interests of high school to take back students that have not graduated. And I think this bill's, the language in this bill, the old language, maintains that piece. I'm not sure. I need you to help me understand here. So I guess the question is, I'll get to the question, which is there anything in here that is going to create an incentive or at least cause a school district to be less concerned about bringing that student back to graduate? Have I made myself clear enough? I'm not sure. I have.
I believe, Representative Springer, Chair Daugherty, if I may repeat your questions to make sure I'm understanding it, your concern is that schools will have an incentive to not bring back individual students upon learning of their status as regards to credits. Is that correct?
Follow-up.
No, not quite. Close. Currently, I used the example, maybe you weren't in the room, that I took by the hand a kid that had not graduated, been out of school then, for he was well under 21, could have been, gotten in. And I was very disheartened by the lack of excitement to have him come back through, and we were given a list of alternatives. Because of the reporting methods and the way we grade schools, and Section 2 talks about the report card, that doesn't help districts. Now, this isn't about who's to blame. This is about how to get these kids diploma. And by the way, this kiddo should have his diploma next week.
Okay.
And it's a diploma, not a GED, from the local community college. So is this going to help that? That's what I want to occur.
To help schools want to bring students back.
Yeah.
All right. Chair Daugherty, members of the committee. This bill, as written, looks at student information in the aggregate. So the challenge with that, well, an opportunity with that, is schools are not able to individually target students for non-acceptance, right? We're not singling out individual students as, if you would, problem students or those most challenging to get to graduation. As far as incentivizing schools to bring in high school students, I think that that is, it's not addressed specifically in the bill. I think that's incumbent on directors of schools, school districts, and ourselves to help the schools understand the context of these students and what it is that they need. That data by itself doesn't change practice is something that we know, and it's incumbent on us to make sure that we're helping. And when I say we, I mean me as a public affairs person, Dr. Bullock as a school director, policymakers at the state level, the Oregon Department of Education, to provide the kinds of information that lead to opportunities for bringing in the students so that this is not seen as a potential hindrance to them, but as an opportunity to actually provide opportunities for students.
Okay. Representative Clay?
The question that I have is, because I think it's more than just, like you said, gathering information. We know right now that there's some students that are graduating in 3 years, some that are graduating in 4, some 5, and some even 6. And so the data that you're asking for as far as why deficient, you know, as part of a study that I also am hoping will go forward. And that is a situation where you're trying to figure out, does it matter if it's 3 or 4 or 5 or 6? Depending on what the need of that particular child is and what the opportunities are for them to recover credit. So in looking at your bill, Is it just the simple, they're 3 credits short, they're 5 credits short, they're 2 credits short, or is it trying to look for something more than just the raw data? I guess I'd ask.
Chair Doherty, Representative McClain. I think it's more illustrative of what the situation is in the aggregate with graduation rates in Oregon, and if you, I mean, this bill comes back to grad rates and some of the factors. I mean, certain school may have an 80% grad rate, another school may have a 30% grad rate, but they're both doing a good job with the student body that they have. And I think this is trying to get at more data to help determine what is that student body made up of. There is nothing in the bill today that compels any action from anybody. It's a collection of data that is then used by, as Iris said, by the professionals that in you know, the legislature, the schools, and the department to compel action from that point.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay, thank you very much, panel. Tim Cowan?
Chair, is this on 2658?
This is on 2898.
I'm on 26, I'm sorry.
Okay, it's okay. Oh, signed the wrong piece of paper. Okay, anybody else to speak on this bill? Okay, if not, I close a public hearing on House Bill 2898 and open up a public hearing on 2658. If you want to read what it is, Representative Peluso, would you like?
Yeah, Chair Doherty, members of the committee, House Bill 2658 requires the Oregon Department of Education to establish a pilot program to distribute money towards school districts to hire school social workers and increase the working hours of existing school social workers and enable existing personnel to earn their school social worker license. It appropriates $20 million out of the general fund for the pilot program and becomes effective July 1st, 2017. It does have a reporting requirement. There is a Dash 1 amendment available on OLIS. The amendment removes the inclusion of school social workers to the list of qualifying professions for school districts and education service districts to receive money. And it removes the $20 million allocation of the general fund resources. It appropriates money from the high school graduation college and career readiness fund from ballot measure 98. And removes monies for the pilot program.
Thank you. Chair Gavel, didn't she?
Yes, she
okay,
did.
Very good. All right, we'll testifying Representative Peluso and Representative Doherty. Welcome. You state your name for the record, please.
You bet. Hello, I am Representative Carla Peluso. I represent House District 50, the great city of Gresham. And I am here in my capacity as the chair of the Gresham Barlow School Board to testify on House Bill 2658, which creates pathways to get social workers into our schools. Gresham, which includes the Rockwood neighborhood, is a community of great need and opportunity. This is an area where 40% of the population receives either SNAP or food benefits, and over one-third of the population lives in poverty. Over 40% of our households have a child under 18, and the median age is 27. Over 60 languages are spoken in the homes here. Rockwood families struggle with every aspect of poverty that you can imagine. More often than not, students take that stress with them to school. I've seen this both in my capacity as the Gresham Police Chief and as the chair of the Gresham Barlow School Board. Despite these challenges, I have found that students in the Gresham Barlow School District want to move forward. We need to empower them, and putting social workers in schools is one strong way to do just that. In Gresham and communities across the state, social workers can have a huge impact. Social workers are trained mental health professionals. They offer behavioral and mental health support. They can assist and collaborate with our teachers. They can provide our students with counseling and therapy. Social workers can positively impact mental health, drug use, chronic absenteeism, bullying, and graduation rates. Our students won't give up, and we can't give up on them. School social workers benefit our students and enhance the investments we are already making in our schools. As a pilot program, this will be a good, strong first step to improving educational outcomes and the lives of our children and families. I urge your support of House Bill 2658. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Peluso. Representative Doherty.
Thank you. Chair Wilson, Vice Chair Wilson, Vice Chair Hernandez, and members of the committee, I'm Margaret Doherty, House District member for House District 35, which is Tigard in Southwest Portland. And we bring to you today House Bill 2658, actually -1, and there will probably be a -2 that you don't know about yet, Alethea. But what this does is it goes through and talks about, actually begins and continues the conversation and hopefully the funding for a very important project, and that's to get trained specialists in the elementary schools especially to help kids that are troubled. Back in the olden days when the woolly mammoths roamed the earth and I taught, we had child development specialists in every single elementary and middle school in the state of Oregon. Whether they were in the city of Portland or whether they were in Malheur County, there were trained professionals that helped kids and families that either needed, you know, academic help, whether they needed social help, whatever. And that program has gone away, and so this is something to try to enhance that program. There are many more difficulties facing families and kids today, and I think the one example I use, and I don't know if I've used it here before, but I was visiting one school, and there was a delightful young child in second grade who kept leaving class all the time, and he just wouldn't stay in class. And he wasn't acting out in a violent way, but he just bolted all the time. And even a, you know, bribery of a Halloween costume wouldn't keep him in class. And part of what it was is that this young man the year before had been pulled out of the home because of child abuse or of domestic abuse. And on the phone when he was talking to his mother after he'd been pulled from the home, he asked, he said, "I just hope that Daddy didn't leave bruises on you like the last time." And so these are the sort of emotional and psychological issues that we're dealing with children, and this is why we want to go through and try to encourage this program. Currently, there is a pilot project that deals with trauma specialists, and one that we all approved last session that's going on. With this amendment, and there's actually a companion bill to this in the Senate, is that I believe with the amendments that the dollar amount is taken out of the current, the initial proposal, and there's kind of a blank. And then, and also the idea that it's not only social workers, but it's other trained professionals, again, depending on what the school district needs to go through and do that. And then one other amendment that I will be putting in is in the original bill, it said that a report will come to the legislature every October, starting with the first year of the bill. Well, the first year of this bill, they wouldn't even be hiring people yet. And so instead of having it October of 2017, it would be October of 2018 is when the first report would be in, but we want to make sure that that was very specific. So with this is one of those bills that deals with what we've been talking about for the past couple of years, absenteeism, graduation rates, all of those sort of things start at a very early age. And so I'm hoping that we'll be able to make an investment at the front end with the younger kids so it pays off when they're in middle school and high school. So with that, I'm open to questions.
Thank you. Any questions for our panel? Representative Springer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Specifically to the language of the bill, I don't know if you're looking at it right now. In the first section, it talks about under the pilot program, monies could be distributed to do these things. Mm-hmm. Hire new social workers, things like that, increase hours. And then on line 11, it says, as an option, to enable existing personnel to earn a license as a school social worker and become employed by the school district as a school social worker. Does that mean school district general dollar funds would be used to send some people back to school? And how would that be monitored?
I don't believe that is the intent of that.
What is the...
That I don't
follow.
Know.
Follow what?
What is the intent?
I'm trying to look at the... find the amendment. I believe that that has... I don't know, but I will get back to you.
Thanks. May I follow up?
Follow up.
And yeah. Then...
I'm trying to look at both these. I don't have my glasses, so.
No, you don't.
Yeah.
They're here.
No, what we'll do is, as a matter, we'll just get back to you on that, because I know that there were the -1 amendments dealt with page 1, you know, after line 2 and line 3 and these kind of things, so we'll get back to you on that.
Thank you. Follow-up.
Follow-up.
I was wondering if those might be addressed in the amendments. The other piece of the bill talks about on lines, starting at line 17 on the first page, a school district that participates in the pilot program must annually submit information to the department about how the increase in school social workers affected different things, student attendance, very quantifiable things, reported incidents of acts of harassment, intimidation, and so forth. C is the morale of students and teachers mm-hmm. is one, which is a tough one mm-hmm. to quantify. That's kind of day by day. And then any other elements of the school system, students, or families. What are you thinking of those two pieces?
What it is I think is to look at this all encompassing, and then Representative Peluso can go through. And in the Senate bill, which, as I say, these are almost identical, there actually is a cost factor in that will a dollar amount that will cover these sort of things, you know, to analyze them. But I think when you look at this, and because so many times, whether it's a social worker, trauma specialist, psychologist, you know, counselor, whatever, they deal a lot with the families and they deal a lot with the staff on different issues. And so what it is to see how encompassing this entire program is. There may be some schools that won't report on that because it's not a factor in what they were working on. But this way it gives more leeway and more abilities for the schools to go through and have the programs deal directly with the issues that their children are facing.
Yeah, I agree with what she said.
Brief follow-up. I would just love to talk a little bit about the morale of students and teachers, mm-hmm. how you get there. That can be one thing on Monday and another thing on Thursday.
Yeah.
It really can. So.
All right. Thank you, Representative Parrish.
Thank you. So thanks for bringing this. Today was a day in our world, we probably could have used a social worker at school for a whole other reasons. Curious, though, about, and I voted for the bill that this year building this off of, around that it allowed some of these dollars to go to school-based health centers. But one of the concerns I'm consistently hearing is that when you have sort of that school-based health center, the school-based health center is not really talking to school nurses. Data is not moving sometimes back and forth real well. So if we add social worker into school-based health center, I mean, are we going to have that same type of challenge that some of the nurses are experiencing in schools where there's sort of this disconnect between school nursing and school-based health?
Well, the original bill, Vice Chair Hernandez, Vice Chair Wilson, Representative Parrish, is the last bill that we had was specifically geared to one area. What this is this is expanding it more to the actual schools itself and being able to expand the scope of what professionals will be working with people. And so it is not school-based health centered. It is universally centered.
Can I follow up?
Follow up.
So is the thought process that the social workers would be direct hires of the school district that they're working in so that they could better work with school nurses? Because line 15 does say for school-based health centers potentially. So that's why I'm sort of asking, because I feel like if we're going to make this kind of investment, I would like to see them working directly for the school district, being able to connect to the school nurse, possibly even expanding this and having other sort of mental health type practitioners in the mix. But there's sort of that direct line works for the school district and maybe not a third-party school-based health center where those records don't always talk to each other real well. And I think you need to have that communication of a social worker with the student's teacher, with the student's nurse, you know, if there's a nurse in the building even, but with the people who they can actually share all that records. And sometimes the school-based health centers can't. And so this bill... Well, kind of looks like money would be going to school-based health centers.
Okay. Vice Chair, Representative Pierce, if you look at the rest of the bill, it's a little more expansive. So it not only just talks about school-based health centers, but then also talks about expanding the kind of professionals that will be working with this. But what this is they would be hired by it would be a grant program hired by the school district.
Okay.
Or the ESDs or a regional program, that kind of thing. We want to make it inclusive enough because sometimes a very small district in Eastern Oregon or in Southern Oregon does not have the capabilities of hiring an entire, they may not need a full-time person, but if they combine it with an ESD program, then they'll do that. So that's part, the flexibility is the key on this.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. Representative Bile.
Chair Wilson, I'm really feeling naive, and that's a common feeling since I arrived here February 1st. The definition of social worker has got me a bit puzzled. I'm remembering LCSW, CS, and R something, SW. And then I look in the existing law, and we've got nurses and other people. What is the definition of a social worker as it relates to this bill?
Okay, can I do that
one? Well, Vice Chair Wilson, Representative Vile, there's a variety of ways you can interpret social worker. It's the social worker title is that they've gone through educational school and have gotten that the certificate that says they're a licensed social worker. They can work in elder care homes. They can work in schools. They can work in a variety of places because it's a very broad broad topic. So what we're trying to do with the bill is anyone that can have access to our children and our students and help support them in gaining their self-esteem and the opportunity to succeed in school is who we want as part of the team. And that includes social workers. And again, as generally social workers have what's the equivalent of a master's degree in social work, have some expertise and can either specialize in a certain area or, like I say, be very broad-based.
Yeah, and they've been had internships and so on and so forth. One program that Portland State is beginning, and they now have, I think, 36 or 39 graduates, are school social workers that specialize in schools and school children, age children, and school issues and so on. So,
follow up. Yeah, so that was really where I was trying to get to. Is a school social worker an LCSW, a CSWA, an RBSW, or is there something special called a school social worker that we would be recognizing or creating or have the need to create as a result of this? Because it doesn't really, I'm not clear that an LCSW shows up and says, we're going to put that person in a school and everything's fine.
Rep Vile and Vice Chairs, there is a program now at Portland State that specializes just in that, in their social worker program. And so the whole thing about this is to, again, flexibility for the school district. You have some school districts that will need more mental health specialists, and that's who they would want to hire. You have ones that would have an MSW that might deal more with the families and with the social agencies and so on that they have to do. You might have another that wants them to deal specifically with school social workers, which is another specialty that they have. And so it's the idea of opening it up. But the whole purpose is to have trained people that are trained in whether you want to call them counselors, social workers, trauma specialists, behavioral specialists, school psychologists, child psychologists, whatever.
A school nurse,
all of these. But again, depending on what the schools need. We don't want to dictate to them what sort of specialist they need for their school. That's why it's so wide open.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Rep. Vile. Representative Solman.
Thank you, Vice Chair Wilson. I can appreciate everything that you have touched on and the importance of making sure that what the value that it does for our students in education. Something that struck me when you were talking, though, it made me start thinking that as you were talking about flexibility with the school districts, why are we not considering having this be through our school-based health centers and through our ESDs as professionals not working for the school district, but billing through medical bill. That's probably a naive question. Just throw that out there as well.
Well, no, it could but be. It could be exactly what you said.
So they wouldn't possibly be school district employees. Maybe they would go through, Virginia Garcia runs our...
And then they run a couple of things in Washington County. But what we're looking at is, for example, in an ESD situation, is where you would go through an ESD's school district contract through ESDs.
Okay.
And so, yes, it could be a school employee. It could be an ESD employee. It could be a Virginia Garcia, depending on what it is. But it would still be somebody that is accountable to the district.
Yes.
All right, thank you. Vice Chair Hernandez.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair. This is for Representative Vile. You can go to the licensure board for social workers and see everything that they license in. There are different types of licensure, but I think particularly for school districts, they tend to hire licensed social workers and school-based social workers, school social workers.
Thank you. Representative Parrish.
Thank you. So either of you can answer this. School districts do have the ability right now, though, to hire social workers if they chose, if they had the budget. So I guess the question I have is about the notion of a pilot, other than that we're looking for some funding. It would strike me that if we, as a body, say we want to have social workers in schools, that we would just say we want to have social workers in schools and not have a pilot that creates sort of busy work for ODE to kind of administer and come back and report to us. There's a lot of research out there that shows the efficacy of having social workers with kids who've been traumatized and have had that experience. Are we adding an administrative layer of burden to try to pilot something that legally school districts can already hire those folks, and maybe we don't need to have an administrative cost associated with this potentially at the reporting and the ODE and coming back to us, and you know, when we could just say we want to appropriate some money and start putting it out there? I don't see a need to pilot something that legally we can already do and we just really need to fund.
Vice Chair Wilson, Representative Parrish, you're absolutely right. I mean, at that bottom line. But really what we were trying to do would be a little more creative with that pilot program, again, to go a little more expansive with a huge variety of options of how we could utilize those who are social workers and that are associated with our schools. So, that was really the purpose of a pilot program, was to see if there was value in that. And so that's the goal, is to, you know, we just find that every child might need a different service than the other, and to try and figure out the best way to support our kids in their growth and in their future in a time that seems to be very troubling in a lot of ways around our children.
Okay, thank you. Rep. Hernandez.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Vice Chair. Just to clarify, I think we just passed a bill out of the House floor that would add school social workers to the expanded definition. So as of currently, school districts cannot just hire social workers. They had to use a broad definition through ESD to bring in the social workers that they do have. So under current law, that's not the case, just to clarify. Okay. We just passed the bill.
I recall that, but I also believe that schools have been able to have social workers. Maybe they got them under a different track, yeah. Mm-hmm. But there have been social workers in school. And
so. Okay, we'd like to thank this panel for your testimony today.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Next up to testify, and by the way, we have 7 people to cover in the short time we have left. And let me call forward Nina Fakaris, please. Hi there. Welcome to the committee. And if you'd state your name for the record, we'll be on our way.
Thank you. Thank you, Nina Fakaris. I'm torn today because originally I put that I was testifying against this proposed legislation. And that's based on that the current legislation is based off of the pilot legislation that was passed last year, which does require school districts to go through school-based health centers. I believe it's still in the current legislation, I believe on line 39, that says that it must be assigned to a school-based health center. My concern is, first and foremost, I do support the concept of school-based health centers, especially in areas where there is lack of health care providers. They provide an important safety net to our children and our families around access issues. However, as a school nurse working in Oregon schools for about the last 30 years, I am passionate and an advocate for children. In our school district, had we participated in this original pilot and the way the current language of this legislation reads, as I understand it, that our school-based health center could receive grant monies to pilot the hiring of a social worker who would have access to approximately 260 students, because those are the clients of our current school-based health center. Because of HIPAA-FERPA regulations, that social worker would not have access to the other 1,100 students in that school or the other 40,000 students in my school district. Our school district last year took on the challenge and hired 5 social workers of their own because they recognized the need. Those 5 social workers have served approximately 1,800 kids and their families in the last year. My request is to look at this carefully, especially regarding the budgets. I would suggest adding this money to the school fund, get us closer to that $8.4 billion, and allow school districts to hire their own social workers, because there is the need out there, but there would not be the HIPAA-FERPA regulations that they have to jump through according to the current legislation that ties this bill to school-based health centers. Thank you. Okay. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Okay, any questions? Okay, thank you very much. Okay, the next we have is Jennifer Bergman's, Keila Lynn, and Bobby Reagan.
Is that okay? Good afternoon, Representative Doherty and the members of the committee. My name is Keila Lynn, and I work at the Lebanon Community School District. I am a social worker. I got my degree from Portland State 2 years ago. I've been working in school districts for the last 25 years and decided an education in social work would further my experience, my professionalism with the social work entity and legitimize what I've been doing with kids. I previously have worked for LBL ESD too before I got my licensure, so I'm hearing some of that conversation and feel like, oh, I have some understanding of what the questions that you're asking. I'm going to do a bit of that, knowing that I am a CSWA. I've graduated with my master's degree in social work, and that means that I am working for my licensure. It takes me 3,500 client hours to work for that, as I'm getting clinically supervised by someone who already has their licensure. It is 2,000 specific client hours that I'm in front of them out of that 3,500. So that when that changes, when I take a test, I will then be able to have the opportunity to be an LCSW. So that's where that changes along the way. A school social worker is acknowledged not by that licensure committee, but by the TSPC, the Teachers Practice and Standards Committee. That coming out of the teacher entity would double dip into being able to say that's one more standard with which I would be recognized. I was hired by the Lebanon Community School District as a behavior specialist. I did not need my social work degree to be able to obtain that. I actually work with someone else who has her master's in education. The lens with which I bring as a social worker, being a behavior specialist, is when you're working with students, you have the opportunity to look at what their behaviors are bringing into the picture. And you could acknowledge, you've probably heard about PBIS or positive behavior intervention systems, where you're going to do some encouragement, enhancement, behavior modification, and that is really workable for the majority of our students, but that's not the conversation we're having today. When we're looking at our multi-stressed families, even being able to say what is the precursor to the behavior. As a behavior specialist, that's what we do. We look at functional behavior, which is excellent too. It's another layer. The social worker in me and the social workers that we're talking about to provide is an additional lens. And that holistic approach has the opportunity to not only look at the student and that student's deficits and that lagging skills that a student may have in projecting their attendance or graduation rates. We're talking about the opportunity to say, what is the bigger picture? What is the holistic picture that might be having that child struggle? I think my information got turned in, and I know you can read the details to it. I'm going to tell you a specific. I appreciated the example that you brought to the table, and I'm going to tell you a specific example that overlays that same exact conversation. I have a kindergarten student that I'm currently working with, him and his family. His behaviors has been highly at risk in the public school setting, where he is throwing objects at other kids, rolling around, and intense screaming at the top of his lungs. Really challenging in a class of youngers to be able to say, how can we impact this individual? So the regular systems with which we're going to try at school wasn't able to change the trajectory of that child. And having the conversation with his family, I recognized, we heard in this story, that he had tooth pain, and so to the point that he wasn't able to attend a dentist appointment, and we're to the point of needing to contact DHS because it became reportable. Without him having a next doctor's appointment, the reason why they missed the doctor's appointment is because the mom is in heart failure and dying. She's living with her mom. Grandma is unwilling at this. Grandma is totally willing, sorry, to step up to the plate. But a social worker's paradigm to be able to look at that meso level and be able to recognize that mom has a self-determination and a strength to be there when she can for this child, although we needed a declaration of guardianship paperwork, and I just happened to know how to do that as a social worker, involved in mom being able to sign off for the dentist, and only the dentist at this point. We know that we need the support from grandma in a lot different areas, but at this point, that's all mom is willing to support us in, and that's okay at this point. We've also told her we have someone who will come to the house and get that paperwork signed anytime.
If we could have you summarize, we have five more people in 10 more minutes. So,
we were able to support that family. I was able to make the conversations with the dentist too. I want you to know that. And that macro systems change. I've been meeting with Lynn Council to continue that conversation about delegation of guardianship. I think that that's when you look at social workers, that's the plethora of opportunities that we're able to perform. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Okay, next.
Chair Doherty and members of the committee, good afternoon and thank you for having us. My name is Jenny Bergmans and I am a school social worker. I currently am a CSWA, a clinical social work associate, working towards my licensure. I am also a school social worker and I currently serve as the family services manager for Community Action Head Start in Washington County. I supervise seven family services assistants that provide parent engagement and resources for our high needs families throughout Washington County. They also help children and families who have barriers to school attendance. When a child has been absent, teachers notify the family services assistant, and they will attempt to build a rapport with the family and work with the family to access resources so that they can get their child back to school. They will even do home visits if they have to. With this model, we have seen the tremendous impact that working with a child's family can have on a child's success. Parent engagement is a pivotal piece of the Head Start mission. This is because we know that when parents are involved in their child's education, he or she is more likely to succeed. We also realize that children can only be ready to learn if they have their basic needs met and are not in fight or flight mode. We cannot teach the head when the heart is broken or the mind is troubled. Unfortunately, our schools are becoming increasingly more frightening for our children every day. When children go to school, they have to face the fear that they may be bullied, sexually harassed, beaten up, or even shot. Suicide was the second leading cause of death among persons 10 to 24 years of age in Oregon in 2013. And Oregon suicide rates among persons 10 to 24 years of age have been increasing since 2010. Oregon has already had many instances of potential or actual school shootings. This includes shootings at Reynolds High School, Thurston High School, and more recently at Umpqua Community College, where 9 innocent people lost their lives. Our children have to deal with all this fear on top of whatever adverse experiences that they may be dealing with at home. Research has shown that if children have adverse childhood experiences, or ACEs, They will be more likely to have medical issues in the future. Adverse childhood experiences may include traumatic experiences such as parental separation, having a parent with a mental illness, a parent with a substance abuse issue or who is incarcerated, domestic violence in the home, neglect, physical abuse, or sexual abuse.
And Jennifer, I'm going to have to ask you to wrap it up because we do have four other people.
Okay. So. Well, the effects of adverse childhood experiences may have a big impact on these children in the future. It could cause things such as heart disease, cancer, mental illness, immune disorders, obesity, and even suicide. This is why I feel like prevention is key. As a past Child Protective Services worker for the state of Oregon, I can tell you that these issues are hidden, but they're running rampant throughout our society and through our neighborhoods, rich and poor. Social workers are highly educated in trauma-informed practices and adverse childhood experiences, and they are also specially trained in working with systems and family issues. For these reasons, they are essential to have in our schools. Having social workers in our schools will help to ameliorate adverse childhood experiences. It will keep our children safer, and it will help our children and our communities to thrive. Having social workers in school will also save us money in the long haul. Please join me in supporting House Bill 2658. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Bobby?
Chair Doherty, members of the committee. My name is Bobby Regan. I'm a former longtime member of the Portland School Board. During the past few years, I have regularly attended Portland Gang Task Force meetings, and I serve on the advisory board of Healing Hurt People, a program of Cascadia Behavioral Health. In these arenas, the reality of trauma and the need for trauma-informed care is front and center. For children, trauma comes in many forms, including divorce, separation from parents due to neglect, incarceration, or immigration enforcement, bullying, abuse, housing insecurity, food insecurity, family dynamics, gunfire, or witnessing other violent behavior, and more. Left ignored or untreated, this trauma often leads children to self-medicate with alcohol or drugs. Untreated trauma also makes learning in school nearly impossible. Whether a child is distracted, tired, scared, or experiencing anxiety, all can interfere with their capacity to take in and absorb new teaching and learning. Having grown up in a household myself with an alcoholic father and a bipolar mother, I experienced trauma, anxiety, and fear daily. But my situation was nothing compared with the trauma faced by many of our school children today. House Bill 2658 is a healthy, compassionate, and positive response to trauma, utilizing social workers in schools to provide trauma-informed care. Social workers are trained to recognize the signs of trauma and to intercede early and effectively to support students in working through their trauma and becoming more resilient. We can't change students' circumstances, but we can offer trauma-informed care through licensed, trained social workers in our schools. The results, almost certainly, will include higher attendance, more positive behavior generally, a stronger capacity for students to pay attention, to learn, and to thrive, and possible outreach and support to members of the child's families, including school-age siblings. As healing begins, learning can resume. I do know that a lot of high schools across Oregon are trying to add social workers at the high school level, and I would encourage us to be looking K-12. Trauma knows no bounds when it comes to age. I also didn't hear the very beginning of this introduction of the bill where it talked about Measure 98. I would say that I look at this as a complement to Measure 98, hopefully not a carve-out. So I just wanted to finish by saying I am grateful to Representatives Peluso, Doherty, and Nose for sponsoring this bill. The pilot project and this $20 million investment will pay dividends for years and will most importantly save lives. So I hope you'll give it your consideration and support.
Thank you very much. Do you have any very quick questions? We've got three more people in 5 minutes. Okay, thank you very much for coming down and testifying. Next we have Ellen Baltus, Kathy, and Tim Cowan. And Kathy, I could not read your last name, so thank you.
Hi. My name is Kathy Lehman, and I'm an elementary principal at Lot Whitcomb Elementary School in the North Clackamas School District. I've been an educator since 1989, and for the last 19 years, I've been an elementary school principal. 13 of those years have been in Title I and low-income schools. For the last 4 years, I've been fortunate to be at Lot Wickham and working with a school social worker, Ellen, who's here today. And I've seen firsthand the difference that this can make in our children's lives and in our community. Licensed social workers are able to see a systems level that we sometimes miss in the school. There's community outreach, connections with law enforcement, connections with mental health, physical health. There's that community connection going out into our community and bringing people in, and I see that daily in our school. Our kids don't come to school just with academic needs. They come with the needs of food, health, mental health, self-regulation, social development, and confidence. We've been able to build a trauma-informed care at our school thanks to Ellen and her work and her look at a systems level that helps to measure the growth of our kids and our staff in their own self-care. And I've shortened that as much as I can. So thank you. I very much support this pilot for social workers in our schools, particularly elementary schools.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. Good afternoon, Chair Doherty and members of the committee. Thanks again for letting me share. My name is Ellen Baltus, and I've been a social worker for over 30 years. I have a master's in social work, a license in clinical social work, and a license in school social work, all that are very different. I got my master's in 85. I got my clinical I don't know when I got that LCSD, maybe 10 years ago. And I got my license 2 years ago because it's the license in school social work, and it is through TSPC, and I monitor through TSPC for that license. I pay them, and I pay the other board for my LCSW. And I don't pay anyone just for an MSW once I get it done. I mean, I did pay, but I don't anymore. As a social worker in the North Clackamas School District, because you were asking all those questions, I was like, oh, well, I know that answer. I know the answer about the ability to hire social workers. Like, it should seem like, of course, you can hire social workers, and people could hire social workers in the school district. But I can tell you, I was hired years ago as a child development specialist, and my school district, like Portland, like Beaverton, has sunsetted that program. And so once I retire and leave my school, they will no longer be able to hire a licensed school social worker in my position, social worker of any kind, in my position. And at my school, which has the level of need that it does, a social worker lens has been critical. One of the things social workers are really good at is doing a lot with very little money. We know how to be poor. We know what to do when you have nothing. And we know how to find hope where it seems like there's none. And one of the skills that I have and have acquired over the years of being a social worker is networking, partnering. We have a huge after-school program, and part of that has to do with me partnering with Stanford Children and then community, with county commissioners and then the faith community and then writing a 21st century federal grant. And now we have this robust after-school program that allows the kids in my school to have mentors, to have access to people. We know that resilience from trauma comes from relationships. The other thing that I've done is leveraged people by having a huge mentor program through two high schools. None of this costs money for our school district, and working with partnering with two high schools. In fact, it saves money for the high school because the mentors get credit.
I want to sit back just a little
bit. Sorry, I'm
very
sensitive.
So very sensitive microphones.
Sorry.
Yeah.
I have a really loud voice too anyway, so I probably don't need to be too close. But the high school students get credit without having to have a teacher hired for that class. And they partner with my elementary school. My graduate student helps run that program. So there's no cost to the district, but we have 100 high schoolers. And then there's a private school at LaSalle, a high school nearby, that also brings in these mentors. And so we have 100 kids that have high school mentors that meet with them weekly. In the after-school program, we have people from our community. And actually now kids that have graduated from my elementary school and the high school are coming back and working in that after-school program. So it's like children from their community, teenagers and young adults that are now, because we have that program, have a place to come and to be those role models. And so even though I'm a white woman working in a school that has 50% Latino, I make sure that I have these mentors that these kids connect with. And how that relates to attendance and how that relates to bullying and harassment, I find out what's going on with those kids through those mentors. And that program doesn't cost my district anything. It's because of my social work lens. And as far as attendance is concerned, again, the social work lens has to do with things like if I'm working with a student and we have an attendance court process, which I helped to develop in the county because I realized that there was a place that kids kept dropping off. And so by building this, working, partnering with the Clackamas County District Attorney's Office, have built this attendance court process.
I'm going to have you summarize.
Okay. So I guess what saying as far as for social workers, why there hasn't been able to is because there isn't flexibility in hiring around social workers at the elementary or middle school level. There's usually only one position, and that position, there's flexibility has been taken out by sunsetting the Child Development Specialist Program. This bill or this pilot program would allow for increased flexibility and allows funding that then would make districts look at, oh, I should maybe hire at that level and consider looking at those positions by doing this. And as far as ESDs and student-based health centers, those are not positions that are embedded in the actual school. So to have a social worker embedded in a school to develop those relationships that I do, that when kids walk through the door and they know it's Mrs. B, not a therapist that's sitting in an LCSW, sits in like an office and sees... I have a therapist at my school.
Okay, we're going to have you wrap
so
up here.
It's just a different role than ones that embedded in the school. So it's a more generalist position that we're looking to have. And this bill really supports that idea. So I appreciate it.
That was the idea behind it.
Yes,
Mr. Cowan.
Thank you.
Chair, committee members, for the record, my name is Tim Cowan. I'm going to be really brief because I think I have a parking ticket. I wanted to talk to you about is I've been involved in this for 10 years. It's Roosevelt High School, St. John's Community, Portland School District. As a result of our involvement, we had the greatest improvement in graduation rate in the state. I gave you the brochure, so you just go ahead and look at that. And what I'd like you to do is when you put the pilot program together, please take a look at the template we've designed to see if it also adds some value. Because once you get those teachers excited and you show them that you really care about them, the graduation rate turns around, and so does absenteeism and everything else. So I'd just like you to consider that.
Okay. Fine. Thank you so very much. Any questions of the panelists? We appreciate you guys coming down. We appreciate the what you all do for the kids. And actually, Lot Whitcomb was the area that I lived in when I lived in Milwaukee. So anyway, with that,
awesome.
I close the public hearing on House Bill 2658. And that's it for business. Meeting 58 and